Those that have been run earlier in the week are open only to the press.
50 Division of the 17th Coast Guard District in Juneau. My alternate role is I chair the Alaska Regional Response Team for oil spills. I happen to be in Valdez at this time in place of Admiral Nelson, who departed yesterday and will be back tomorrow. And I'm speaking to you because the on-scene coordinator, Commander McCall, is presently on an overflight and was unable to talk to you. What I'd like to do is to make a couple of prepared statements, copies of which are contained on the table over to my left. And following that, I'll open it up to general questions. The other gentleman with me is Lieutenant Commander Gary Ryder, who is commanding officer of the Pacific Coast Guard, the Pacific Strike Team, located in California, and he and his team are also up here.
Coast Guard spokesman Lynn Haynes is speaking. Lynn Haynes of the U.S. Coast Guard in Juneau.
Oh, spill response. That being the final removal of the oil from the Exxon Valdez, I thought we should get together and briefly review Coast Guard actions and plans to date. Before I begin, however, I would like to try again to clarify one point, that being one of dispersant application. This is continually coming up. Our obligation is not simply to approve dispersants whenever their use is requested by a responder. Our obligation is to ensure that dispersants are applied effectively. To effectively disperse oil spills, three things are necessary: timing, sufficient wave energy to allow dispersant action to occur, and enough dispersant. We were lacking the necessary mix of these three critical ingredients during the early stages of the spill response, and let me speak to each one. Industry and environmental experts agree that the optimum time for dispersant application is in the first 10 to 12 hours. We were notified quickly of the spill. That was not a problem. The request for application of large quantities of dispersant was received nearly 36 hours after the spill. That was a problem. The timing appeared to be wrong. The second problem was that the waters were flat calm for 2 days. We didn't have sufficient wave action to allow dispersant action to occur. The third problem was dispersant availability. During the critical time frame, only 3,795 gallons of dispersant were available. As time passed, more dispersant became available, but by then we had lost the window of opportunity and were hampered by last Sunday's very high winds. Lacking the needed mix of the three elements for success, we felt strongly that the use of dispersants was not an acceptable cleanup option. Of course, we are continuing to work with the state and the spiller to identify any course of action, including dispersant use, which would help in cleaning up this spill. I'll now outline the status of the Coast Guard actions, which are covered in our news release. As the size of the Exxon Valdez spill increases, the Coast Guard is expanding its resources to monitor all phases of cleanup operation. The spill has now impacted areas in a 1,000 square mile zone extending 100 miles south of Valdez into the Gulf of Alaska. By federal regulation, the Coast Guard is required to ensure the proper cleanup of all spills in navigable waters. Members of the Coast Guard Pacific Strike Team and Exxon plan to complete oil transfer operations from the Exxon Valdez by probably Tuesday, maybe Monday night. Since the spill, the strike team has worked virtually around the clock to offload the remaining 42 million gallons that threaten Prince William Sound from the grounded tanker. So far, about 38 million gallons have been removed successfully. The strike team is one of two specialized pollution response teams that is based at Hamilton Air Force Base near San Francisco. The Pacific team, under the command of Lieutenant Commander Gary Ryder, have 13 team members here, along with an inventory of specialized cleanup equipment. The 180-foot Coast Guard buoy tender Ironwood from Kodiak arrived here early this morning, bringing the total number of Coast Guard cutters present to 3. Ironwood will be used as a logistics and supply vessel and will also assist in skimming operations. The Homer-based cutter Sedge, also a 180-foot buoy tender, has recovered 2,255 barrels of oil from the Prince William Sound. I figure for the complete amount recovered is not available at this time. The Coast Guard cutter Rush, a 378-foot high-endurance cutter, was diverted from law enforcement patrols and is being used as a communications and aviation traffic control platform. There is an FAA representative and members of the cleanup personnel on board to assist with air traffic control. There are presently 405 Coast Guard people locally involved with the cleanup, along with three helicopters and a C-130 aircraft. This does not include the additional support that is being all the way through Alaska, from Juneau to Kodiak, and even to points in the lower 48. In addition, a total of 100 vessels are presently participating in this cleanup operation. That concludes the prepared brief. And
Captain, could you tell us what you're prepared to do in billing Exxon for all this? I mean, your involvement is becoming more and more extensive as each day goes by. Are you going to send them a big bill?
You bet we'll send them a big bill. I'd like to clarify that a little bit. Most of the equipment that we have brought up on behalf of Exxon, and this includes Navy equipment, the Navy Mako 5 skimmers, a lot of the boom, that type of equipment is directly chargeable to Exxon. The cost of the Coast Guard response, the use of the high endurance cutters, the buoy tenders, the personnel costs of everyone that's up here is part of the what we call OG-30 or operating fund. I am not sure as to how much of that can be or will be billed to Exxon, but certainly the major ticket items that are being brought up will be, yes.
Can you please update us in terms of where the vessel will be going? First of all, where's it going for repairs, immediate underwater repairs, and then where does it go after that?
Okay, as I understand it, and this has been discussed at length, obviously, once the vessel is floated free, which is expected to be during the high tide period of this week, where we do have some exceptionally higher tides, the vessel will be refloated. Now, this is after calculations by at least six different naval architects from six different locations. I mean, everybody's looking at this. The vessel will then be moved over to Outside Bay, which is in the southwest corner of Naked Island. That particular area has been oiled, so it is not something that is has not been impacted. It does have good holding ground. It meets the requirements of all of the federal and state agencies that had a cut on this. It meets Exxon's needs because it is sheltered from the prevailing northeast and southeast winds. Oh, of course.
Are the Coast Guard concerned about the structural structural damage to this ship during the low tides in the same week?
We have been watching it. We've had strike team personnel on board and also personnel from the Marine Safety Office here in Valdez during the entire operation. We were so concerned about it, as was Exxon, that a lot of the lightering or the removal of the product off this vessel has been done in a manner which certainly could have been done faster, but at much greater risk to the vessel. So basically, as tanks were emptied, other tanks were flooded to keep the vessel in just about the same location on the reef. They have had some minor lifting during high tide periods. Low tide doesn't seem to have been a problem. There has been some buoyant action as we've approached the end of the lightering. But yes, that was a major concern and certainly was being watched.
Is it still a major concern?
Not as much now. We've been able to get divers down. Exxon, has been able to put divers down continuously, and we have a very good feel as to the extent of the damage. About, I would say, Saturday or Friday of last week, we started becoming much more optimistic as to the condition of the vessel and whether or not we were going to lose it where it was.
Once you get it repaired, is it then going to be brought into Valdez Harbor, number one? And number two, once the vessel is removed, are you going to have to take a kinder view at toward allowing more tanker traffic through the narrows?
Well, let's we'll take the first one first. Repaired once the vessel is determined to be safe to be towed to Portland, Oregon, which is the dry dock area, she will be towed down there for permanent repairs or completely rebuilding of the vessel. I'm afraid I'm not qualified to indicate what the future of tanker traffic into Valdez would be. I have to assume that that the operation will continue with whatever increases. This whole thing is being looked at by the Secretary of Transportation and at the highest levels of the federal government, and I'm sure of the state also.
Coast Guard, in terms of the traffic, tanker traffic?
I think we have to really explain how the tanker traffic works. A facility has been built. It is permitted by the state to do an operation. The Coast Guard authority in this area is to make sure that the tankers are inspected and to make sure that the transfer at Alyeska from the terminal to the ship is done under Coast Guard federal regulations. As far as the equipment that's being held there for pollution abatement, that is a state permitting issue. And as far as whether the Coast Guard would deny any future traffic, there is no intention at this time to do it, but we certainly are going to be looking at what we can do to prevent something like this again.
Has the Coast Guard done anything to upgrade its radar equipment since this accident?
Not since this accident, no. That's only been 8-9 days ago. I'm sure the whole issue is being looked at by ACE Navigation in Washington, yes. Locally, we have no control as to what is in there, but I do know for a fact that there is an action committee in Washington within the Coast Guard that is studying the radar situation.
Next base on one of these tankers, is it something that could be done to put boom material on the tankers so the tankers would carry their own boom?
This has come up a number of times. It is not a federal requirement to do so. With the weather that we get up here, I would question how secure it would be, and it also very well might interfere with transfer of cargo on there. I don't see that as something that would really resolve what happened in this particular case. Matter of fact, quite frankly, once this grounding occurred, I'm not sure that anything could have saved us from what has occurred.
Are there some equipment problems in terms of unloading the oil? Is that also one of the reasons that the process has been slower than you expected?
Initially, yes. Initially, they were planning to offload the intact tanks, which were all the tanks on the port side. When they went to pump those tanks off using the ship's system, which would have been a much more effective way of doing it and more rapid, what they found was that they were losing oil. And so they immediately stopped it, and what they feel has happened is that the centerline manifold, if you will, it runs along the bottom of the ship inside, was ruptured in the grounding. And so we had to secure from that, and the Coast Guard brought in what we call ADAPS pumps, which Commander Ryder, I will ask him to address as to what type of operation was doing, what the pumping rates have been. Gary, would you want to touch on that for a minute?
Just that our pumps are pretty much like commercial pumps that have been placed on board the vessel since our initial response are designed and were developed for offloading tankers. And basically they pump at about, we've been making about 1,000 barrels an hour per pump, so.
Were there some problems with equipment that slowed things down? That was my understanding.
There has really been no problem with our equipment. We've had some equipment problems, later on after they've been pumping for 9 days or so, but at 24 hours a day. So, but by that time, replacement equipment had been brought in by Exxon commercial equipment, and the flow is only increased as far as the submersible pump systems on board.
Can you describe the extent of the repairs?
They're going to be made at Naked Bay, and maybe how you're going to do that?
I don't think I can address that right now, only because until they refloat the vessel, you have to understand where the vessel is sitting right now. There was a certain amount of the hull underwater body that has not been able to be seen because it's up against the rock, and you can't safely send a diver down. Obviously, there's nothing there that's going to be worth a man's life. So until the vessel is refloated and moved over where they can do some more examinations of it and also to come up with the calculations that are being worked on right now, I really don't know how much repairs are going to be necessary to safely ensure the transit back to Portland. And so that's something I'm really not qualified to get into right now, and I think I would leave that to Exxon anyway to address anything like that.
Can you tell me what risks?
Captain Hayes. Yeah, thank you. This person to know this issue. When was that? Can you give me a pretty exact time as to how long it took Alyeska or Exxon, and which one it was, to implement the plan of wanting to request the use of dispersants? It says close to 36 hours. Do you have a specific time, and who made that request? You're the chairman, right, of the RRT?
I'm the chair of the chair the RRT for coastal spills. The request goes to the OSC, okay, which is Commander McCall. We have just recently, after a two-year study with industry and with the local fishing community, had finalized a pre-approval of dispersant use in Prince William Sound. This was following a two-year study where we did it for Cook Inlet. This, unfortunately, was a very rapid test of that plan. The spill occurred shortly after midnight on the 24th. The OSC received a request to test a certain amount. Because it was flat calm, we were not very confident as to what would work, you know, whether we'd be able to do it. They asked to do a helicopter test using a helicopter hopper. That was done Friday night on the leading edge of the spill. That was a very small amount of dispersant. I don't have the exact figure. More tests were requested and granted by DC-6 and C-130 on Saturday. And it wasn't until, I believe, Sunday that there was a large amount of dispersants available. By this time, the conditions were 36 hours old, and the wind had changed from flat calm to 40, 50 knots. Most of the flights, as I understand it, were grounded late Sunday through Monday. So we had, at that point, really lost the bubble as far as any dispersant over the weekend.
Sometime on Sunday, could you be a little more specific?
I really can't. Commander McCall, you know, would have received that, and I just don't have that information.
Captain, what's going to happen with the 600,000 barrels, possibly that much of oily wastewater? Will that be towed to Portland, and what will be done?
You mean what's been taken off already?
They're taking that off then, along with the last of the oil, and putting it on the Bay Town. Is that?
Yes, and that will all go south.
Sir, can you tell me what risks are inherent in refloating a vessel of this size and what sorts of things you have to watch out for?
I am not a naval architect. We do have naval salvage people or salvage people on scene, and Gary probably has a much better handle on that. He's been certainly involved with more than I have. You want to see if you can touch on that?
Well, I'm no salvage expert myself by any means. You know, there's always an inherent danger in any stranded vessel because of the stability problems you have. And in our pumping operations, we follow the directions of a salvage master that's much more proficient or professional in that area, and we basically pump the tanks that he wants to the limit that he wants, just so he can maintain the stability.
But as air is introduced, is there a risk of the ship cracking or snapping or turning turtle? Or
well, as I say, I think anytime you have a damaged vessel, you have that problem, and you have to rely on a salvage expert to guide the operation.
Yeah, we have a minus tide coming up at about 6 o'clock on Monday evening. Are you really? I'm sure you're not comfortable with it. Do the salvage experts seem to think that that's not going to be too much of a risk?
Well, obviously, we can't do anything about the tide that's going to come. We have been working now, and they have been working with the calculations on the vessel and the damage study sufficiently. And as I said, that by the end of last week, they were considerably more optimistic. And obviously, they were looking ahead as to what the minus tide period is going to be and how they would have to have the ship loaded to get through that period. I have not sat down with the salvors. So as far as my feeling of comfort, I will be comfortable when the vessel is in Portland, Oregon. But to beyond that, I think they're taking very, very responsible care in doing everything they can to minimize any damage to the vessel.
Sir, who's going to salvage that tanker? Is that yet decided? I'm not yet.
Exxon has contracted, you know, with the salvage people to do it. It's an Exxon salvage operation. I don't have the name of all of the people involved that they're going to. It's their own people in many cases. I'm sorry, could you
repeat? Is it decided yet?
As to who is going to salvage it? Exxon is salvaging their vessel. Now, they have hired the experts to do it. They brought in their own experts, and they've also hired, the vessels and everything to do the salvage work.
First, can you give us the spelling of your name?
Just like the town, H-A-I-N-E-S.
G-L-E-N-N.
Just like the highway outside of Anchorage, right?
Right. So it's from the lower 48. If you had to do it all over again, would you do it the same way? And what lessons have we learned from all this?
If I had to do what all over again?
To respond to a disaster of this magnitude.
I've been waiting for somebody to ask me that. I don't think that any of us in any of the modes that are responding had any conception of what a spill of this magnitude would entail, especially with the logistics up here. Are we going to learn something out of this? You bet we're going to learn something out of it. Even the smallest spills, our response mechanism gets better, and we're able to identify areas that we need to work on, areas of equipment acquisition that the Coast Guard may want to look at, how we can better use Coast Guard resources. And we've been singularly unfortunate this year in Alaska. We've had a number of bad spills off of the Aleutians, and so this has been an ongoing problem since about December 10th. But this particular case, was mind-boggling. And everybody is saying, what if, how can we do it better? Obviously, the response needed for something like this is almost beyond comprehension. But yes, it'll go under very close scrutiny by the on-scene coordinator, by my staff, as to how we can better respond in the future and what the weak areas were and, quite frankly, what the strong areas were. We have enough people from all over the world here helping us, from Canada, from, Norway, other experts that we're learning from also. And we do this through oil spill conferences, but this makes it a lot more meaningful and real.
I'm going to try one more time because I don't think I got my question across about the tanker traffic. We really have two major effects here. One is environmental, the other is economic and more short term, and that is the flow of oil from the Alaska pipeline has been cut in half by your restrictions.
Okay, yes.
And when are you going to lift the restrictions? Is it contingent upon the removal of this tanker, or is that just part of it?
Okay, I didn't understand your question before. I apologize for that. The tanker traffic into Valdez is right now being daylight operation only with tug support at the captain of the port's order, which is Commander McCall. He wears three hats, by the way, up here. As soon as as he has explained it to me, his plan is as soon as the lightering is done, not when the tanker is off, But when the lightering is done, then he will go back to at least nearly normal operation. We have another tug coming in today, which will ease, it was scheduled to come in today, I haven't got confirmation that it is, that will be used for escorting vessels in and out, and that will also ease up the congestion. We know that it's a hardship. We know we've had several requests to be a little bit more lenient. Quite frankly, in our discussions, the feeling was if we were going to increase the risk, even marginally, of something affecting the lightering of that vessel, then we would not grant it. If, in fact, more could be done without increasing the risk, and I mean the risk based on the circumstances today, then we would do it. And we have speed to things.
Maybe Tuesday the restrictions would be largely lifted in terms of traffic.
I really can't speak for him, but I would say, we're looking at Tuesday as being the completion of the lightering. It may be Monday. I really don't know how fast the last 150 barrels can be taken off, but certainly it will be in the next day and a half.
Back to the dispersions issue for just a second. Had wind and sea conditions been ideal at the time of the spill, was there enough dispersant on hand or within 10 hours of Valdez to make any dent in this spill?
There was not enough on hand to have made a dent in it. How fast Exxon or Alyeska could have brought in more quantities of it, I don't know. All I do know is when they did, but not how fast it could have. I just don't know.
Couldn't that material have been on hand?
One of the problems, I indicated that we just approved a pre-approval, dispersant pre-approval plan for Prince William Sound. One of the problems traditionally in Alaska and maybe elsewhere is that the United States has not used dispersants in any great amounts at all. It is a very rigid approval process. The state has to approve the use. The EPA has to approve the use, and the federal trustees have to, DOI and DOC, have to approve the use of a dispersant in an area that does not have pre-approval. The pre-approval process has taken about 2 years. We have just now completed that. Industry, in all fairness to them, has not gone to stocking great amounts of dispersants that historically they have not been allowed to use.
If they weren't allowed to use dispersants, what was the plan to stop a major oil spill in Prince William Sound?
You'd have to go to Alyeska on that one or to Commander McCall. This is not as far as...
Keep track of how authorities plan to stop things like this?
The Alyeska dispersant or the Alyeska response for oil spill is not a Coast Guard responsibility, no. That is the state. It's part of the permitting for the Alyeska facility.
Do you know of any way to stop a major oil spill like this?
Do I know how to contain and stop, short of preventing the grounding of a 10 million gallon spill? No. Not with any degree of success.
What about a 5 million gallon spill?
We're playing numbers. I'm trying
to determine if there is any sort of effective plan for controlling spills in Prince William Sound. That's the object of the question.
Do you want me to commit?
For 100% response, not at this time. There is insufficient resources or ability to do it. And I would say that that would be anywhere in the world. I don't think anyone could handle an instantaneous discharge. We are talking about 10 million gallons ending up in the water in less than 3 hours. We're not talking about a grounding and a slow leak, which we could have responded to. We're talking about a catastrophic release. Yes.
Captain Haynes, when do you plan to require pilot ships to take the pilot boats to take the ships out to sea completely?
We've never required pilot boats. We've required pilotage. Those regulations are in effect. There are revisions in the Administrative Procedures Act, advanced proposed rulemakings right now that are on the street. That certainly is going to be looked at again, I'm sure, in light of this incident. But this is national. This is not specific for Prince William Sound. This is national pilotage requirements.
Excuse me, we're getting ready for Exxon to come in here in a few minutes. The folks want to set up. So if we could ask two more questions, we'd like to stop this, and we'll meet you outside if you have anything additional. But we want to give the Exxon people a chance to set up.
Captain, you mentioned earlier the response needed for this is almost beyond comprehension. It seems to me when you've done the analysis and you learned the lessons, one of the things that's going to happen is it's going to be very expensive to have whatever you're going to ask to sit here, stay here for 5, 10, 20 years, whatever it takes. What is your, who's going to want to have stuff sit here for that long to clean up something that might happen once in a lifetime that's going to be beyond comprehension, that's going to cost a lot of money? How are you going to get somebody to do that?
This is a problem totally in the United States. We don't have a industry-based oil pollution response mechanism nationally. I think what you may see is more cooperation, or not cooperation, but cooperative ventures to possibly have some of the equipment that we might be able to get more rapidly deployed nationally. I really don't, this it's far-reaching. All I can say is that something like this has shaken the response community right down to its heels, and I think that, there's going to be an awful lot of research into how can we better do it. Now, what is it going to take? How much is it going to cost? Who's going to be willing to do what? That's crystal balling, and I'm not sure right now how that's going to work out.
Will the American Bureau of Shipping get to sign off on the salvage work on this tanker?
You betcha. The vessel is ABS classed, and they are acting on behalf of the Coast Guard also in doing that. The Officer in Charge of Marine Inspection, Commander McCall again, will be getting their input. They will be up here. They're part of the calculation team that's doing the calculations on this. Thank you.
And that was the concluding remarks by Coast Guard Captain Glenn Haynes, who is the spokesman who has stepped in for Admiral Nelson. Admiral Ed Nelson, who is the commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District, which is all of Alaska, has been at these meetings and been in town. He apparently has left, returning to his command center in Juneau. And Captain Haynes was the spokesman today. We also heard from Lieutenant Commander Gary Ryder, who's the leader of the Pacific Strike Team, a Coast Guard response force. Some of the issues covered today, we did hear some update on just some of the activities, the lightering. They still hope to have the lightering done early next week. That date has slipped. Originally, estimates were for yesterday, and then today. Evidently, as the oil gets lower and lower in the affected cargo holds, submersible pumps become less effective. We did hear for the first time the official word on where the Exxon Valdez will be going after it is successfully removed from the rocks. The Exxon Valdez, after floating or being refloated, this plan currently is to move it to Outside Bay, which is a bay in the Naked Island area. It meets the criteria that are established. It's a good holding ground. The anchors will hold. The water depth is adequate, but not too deep to allow anchoring and allow workers in there. It's a sheltered area. And one of the criteria, sad to say, the criteria is that it's an area that already has been oiled. We also heard today that following emergency repairs, evidently in the Outside Bay area, the tanker will be towed to Portland, Oregon, to dry dock. So that news new this afternoon. Currently, the restrictions we were clarified on tanker traffic are daylight only, with tug support. Tankers are allowed to come and go, and that's by order of the captain of the port. So I don't know whether each individual sailing or arrival is specifically permitted, but the captain of the port can change the restrictions or stop traffic at any time. We did hear word from the Coast Guard that as soon as the lightering is done, as soon as all of the oil or as much as is going to be removed from the Exxon Valdez has been transferred to other Exxon tankers, then the port will return to, quote, nearly normal operation. Finally, in response to a series of questions by members of the press, Coast Guard Captain Glenn Haynes basically admitted that there is no system of response in place in Prince William Sound or anywhere else in the world to contain a catastrophic release of 10 million gallons of oil. The bottom line seems to be, in retrospect, no one anywhere really has the response capability to handle the kind of event that we experienced here on Good Friday. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we expect an Exxon briefing, the first since the sort of tumultuous press conference 2 days ago that was disrupted in the Valdez Civic Center. Since then, Exxon has not made any public announcements. This meeting, unlike the others, is not being held in the Valdez Civic Center, which is a large building with many facilities. This is being held in the Valdez City Council Chambers, a much smaller building with more controlled access that is next door to the Valdez police station. Security is very much in evidence. There are requirements for rigid screening and checking of press credentials before people are allowed into the room. And again, this is all changes that have occurred since the incidents we witnessed a couple of days ago. I'm Dave Hammack. I want to thank technician Chris Bedalek of the Alaska Public Radio Network. We've had assistance from volunteer Trish King. Back at the KCHU studios, Mary Beth Joyce is engineering. Through the cooperation and efforts of local radio station KVAK in Valdez, this broadcast has been transmitted to Alaskom for broad distribution to other Alaskan stations, to the Alaska Public Radio Network, and to ABC News. I am Dave Hammack from the Valdez City Council Chambers, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.